Testimony, Mr. Lacey, you had not seen your cousin since the year 1891, is that correct? I never said I saw her. Mr. Lacey tugged at his cravat. I meant that she told me by killing her husband and running. If that's not an admission of guilt, I don't know what is. The people on the benches were twisting and murmuring to each other, doubt spreading through the courtroom like a disease. The coroner had to raise his voice to be heard over the hum of voices. When did you arrive in New York, Mr. Lacey? Mr. Lacey hesitated just a moment before saying reluctantly, The 7th of January, the day after Mr. Van Dyvil's death. The coroner made a note to himself. Janie could see Mr. Lacey craning his neck to try to read it. Mr. Lacey abruptly pulled his chin back in again as the coroner looked up. Did you see Mrs. Van Dyvil, Mrs. Bayard Van Dyvil, here in New York? Mr. Lacey cracked his gloves against his knee. I couldn't have, could I? She was already dead. The coroner frowned at his callousness. What brought you to New York, Mr. Lacey? I wanted to see my cousin, said Mr. Lacey impatiently. The architect fellow wrote me, telling me that Van Dyvil wanted to rebuild his wife's childhood home, so I came to see Annabel. What else was I to think? I didn't know that Georgie was holding herself out as Annabel. The coroner looked at Mr. Lacey over his spectacles. But how could Annabel Lacey be alive if she had already been killed by Georgiana Smith? Mr. Lacey looked as though he were trying very hard not to punch something. I don't know. The coroner bared his teeth in a smile. You may step down, Mr. Lacey. Mr. Lacey blinked at him. But I'm not finished. Thank you, Mr. Lacey. If we need you again, we will call you. Bailiff, will you escort Mr. Lacey back to his seat? The bailiff wasn't large, but he had the majesty of the law about him. Mr. Lacey gave him a dirty look, but went. Janie could see the reporters scribbling frantically in their notebooks, some already slipping out the back. Janie's eyes followed Mr. Lacey as he retreated to his seat, folding his arms across his chest in a way that signified both boredom and irritation. The irritation seemed genuine. The boredom didn't. His right leg was jiggling up and down in a way that spoke of anxiety. Anxiety about what? Janie jumped as an elbow connected with her ribs. Janie! Hissed Anne, and nodded towards the stand, where the coroner was calling, Miss Van Dyvil? The walk to the witness stand felt far longer than Janie would have imagined. She gathered up her skirts and ascended the steps into the witness stand, grateful for the hat brim that helped hide her face. In front of her, the faces of the people crammed onto the benches seemed distorted into caricatures of themselves, mouths too wide, eyes too large, all of them staring at her, marking her every movement, the press artists scribbling pictures of her into their notebooks. Despite herself, her eyes sought out Burke, sitting to the side of the press bench. He lowered his chin just a fraction, and Janie, who shouldn't have felt strengthened by the gesture, did. These past few weeks had changed her, toughened her. Settling herself in the hardwood chair, Janie looked to the coroner to let him know she was ready. "You are Miss Jane Van Dyvil," said the coroner. "Genevieve," Janie corrected the coroner, deliberately not looking at Burke. "Miss Genevieve Van Dyvil." The coroner made a note. Janie wondered if he were noting her name, or if it was just a tactic designed to lend an appropriate air of gravity to the proceedings and force witnesses to think very, very carefully before they said anything at all. There was, to be fair, a clerk recording the proceedings, but that didn't have the same weight as a note in the hand of the Grand Inquisitor. Or patent medicine salesman, as the case might be. Janie was beginning to have a great respect for the patent medicine salesman. Perhaps Putnam County's coroner selection process had more sense in it than her mother claimed. Miss Van Dyvel, said the coroner, in a very different voice than the one he had used for Mr. Lacey. You were at the entertainment at Dyvel's Kill on the 6th of January? Janie nodded. Illyria, she said helpfully. My brother and his wife called the house Illyria, after the island in the Shakespeare play. She caught her mother's eye on her and subsided. Yes, thank you. The coroner looked like he was going to say something, and then changed his mind. When he spoke, he chose his words carefully. When were you made aware that something was not as it should be? Janie arranged her hands in her lap, and then arranged them again. She felt as though she suddenly had too many fingers. My cousin, Mrs. Newland, came to find me. My mother had asked that she find my brother and his wife. Your mother? That would be Mrs. Peter Van Dyvel? Janie looked at her mother, who was doing a very good job of pretending the vulgar throng behind her simply didn't exist. Or, for that matter, the coroner, the stenographer, or her daughter on the witness stand. Mrs. Van Dyvel sat like patience on a monument, stony in her stoicism. Yes. What happened then? There was something hypnotic about the coroner's even voice. We went outside. She could feel the cold, a shock after the crush in the house, the way her skin prickled at it, the patterns of light from the house turning the frost to something beautiful and sinister. Janie drew in a deep breath. There were to be illuminations in the garden at midnight, just before the German. We thought perhaps Bay, Mr. Van Dyvel, had gone to make sure everything was in place. Had he? I don't know. That was the truth. She didn't know why Bay had gone outside. The illuminations had been designed to appear over the folly. She could remember the lights crackling and bursting over her head as she knelt by Bay's body, the incongruity of the triumphal flare in the sky, and the devastation below. But there had been nothing in the folly itself, no reason for Bay to be there. The fireworks had been blasted into the sky from elsewhere on the grounds. Unless he had wanted to look at them from below? But why? The full effect had been made to be seen from the balcony. She knew because she had read about it in the papers. The Van Dyvel acorns and rising sun, the Lacey birds and arrows, and at the culmination, an intertwined A and B. Annabel and Bayard. Her brother's guests had eaten and danced and oohed at the fireworks, never knowing that their host lay dead in the folly by the river. Miss Van Dyvel? Janie felt her cheeks flush. Yes? What did you see then? The coroner's voice was very gentle. No wonder, he probably thought he was dealing with a half-wit. My brother, she said. He was lying on the flagstones of the folly. There was a knife in his chest. The coroner nodded to the bailiff. This knife? The bulbous gems still glistened in the hilt, cabochon sapphires and rubies. It looked so innocent, but for the rusty stains along the blade. Janie swallowed the bile rising in her throat. Yes. Do you know whose it might have been? There was no urgency to the question. They knew this already. Janie nodded, doing her best to keep her voice steady. Yes. My brother's. It was part of his costume. Like her mother's pearls, or the aquamarines sewn into Annabel's dress. Nothing but a bauble. A bauble with a blade. When you arrived at the folly, was there any sign of Mrs. Bayard Van Dyvel? Yes. Janie could feel the change of mood in the room. Giles Lacey looking at her from beneath hooded lids. Did he practice? She wondered irrelevantly. Her mother, face frozen in the expressionless disdain that was her way of ignoring everything that displeased her. Anne, twisting the tail of a fox around and around one finger. I saw my sister-in-law in the river. Are you quite certain, Miss Van Dyvel? The dark, the snow, the flickering light of the lanterns. Memory played tricks. People remembered what they thought they ought to have seen. But this wasn't what she thought she ought to have seen. This is what she had seen. Yes, Janey said determinedly. The river wasn't frozen yet. But cold, so cold. The coroner beckoned to the bailiff, who came forward bearing a single shoe. Miss Van Dyvel, do you recognize this shoe? The satin shimmered against the dull tones of the courtroom like Cinderella's glass slipper. That is Annabelle's shoe. She was wearing pale blue. Pale blue that sparkled like water. But not like those waters. The waters of the Hudson had been a dark gray that night, cold and treacherous. The tides in the Hudson ran strong, and Annabelle's dress had been heavy, sewn with gems. Of his bones are coral made. Those are pearls that were his eyes. The coroner gestured again to the bailiff, who replaced the shoe on its stand. And do you recognize this brooch, Miss Van Dyvel? The bailiff silently displayed the diamond brooch. In the courtroom, among the peeling paint and the scarred wood, it looked like a child's bauble, a chunk of glass set in wire. Until the facets caught the light, and it blazed as no glass ever had. Slowly, she shook her head. That wasn't Annabelle's. Are you quite certain, Miss Van Dyvel? The coroner glanced out the window, where the snow had been falling since morning. Falling and stopping, falling and stopping. Yes, she said. I am quite certain. A little murmur of interest about the room. Do you know whose brooch it was? The coroner inquired. Janey could almost picture it pinned to a bodice between two long ropes of pearls. It was like trying to remember the whole of a song from a handful of notes. It taunted her and then slipped away again. No, she said. I'm sorry. Do you know how the brooch might have arrived at that particular spot? There were lanterns in the gardens, said Janey slowly. Pleasure gardens that no one had visited, because there wasn't much pleasure to be had in a garden in January. Anyone might have gone down there at any point in the evening. Even as she spoke, Janey thought how unlikely it was that anyone would have lost such a jewel and not reported it missing. Just because the rich were rich didn't mean they were careless with their belongings. Miss Van Dyvel, said the coroner, can you recall anything else? Anything at all that might aid us in our inquiries? That sensation of not being alone, the creeping feeling of being watched. No. That wasn't something she could share without feeling foolish. She'd be seeing fairies and hobgoblins in the woods next. But there was something else. My brother was still alive when we found him, said Janey, choosing her words carefully. He tried to speak. Pens poised, notebooks out, half-nodding heads upright again. The coroner managed to keep his voice even and calm. What did he say, Miss Van Dyvel, to the best of your recollection? George. It was hard to hear, Janey said apologetically. The river and the wind, his voice wasn't very strong. Was there anything that you could recognize? Feeling her mother's eyes on her, Janey was beginning to be sorry she'd said anything, but this was a court of law, and she was under oath. It sounded like it might be a name. It began with G. Mr. Lacey popped up like a jack-in-the-box.
Georgie, I told you! She killed him! You have it from Van Dyvel's own lips, damn you!
Banging the gavel, the coroner said heatedly, Mr. Lacey, if you cannot control yourself or your language, I will have you removed. I would remind you that there are ladies present. Mr. Lacey subsided into his seat with a curl of his lip, but he looked ready to spring up again at any moment. Gently, the coroner said. Miss Van Dyvel, was it Georgie? Bay's lips barely moving. George. It might have been. At Mr. Lacey's look of triumph, Janie added, it might also have been Giles. Mr. Lacey's eyes narrowed on her in a way that made Janie feel the cold straight through to her chemise. I don't know, Janie said, and at least that was true. She didn't know. It was just too hard to hear. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Miss Van Dyvel. You may stand down.
The coroner looked again at the window and came to a decision.
Given the inclement weather, I hereby adjourn this court until Monday. The jury will deliberate at that time.
No further testimony? Shouted a reporter.
I believe, said the coroner, shuffling his papers together, that we have heard quite enough.
Or,
murmured Mr. Burke, wiggling his way to Janie's side to offer her a hand down from the witness stand,
that he needs to get back to work and this is dragging on too long.
Janie could feel the warmth of his gloved hand on hers, straight through the leather of her gloves. Her gloves had been purchased more for elegance than utility.
Would he really conclude the inquest without an answer?
Mr. Burke used his body as a shield to provide her a clear path to the side of the room, keeping his voice low.
If you want predictions, get a crystal ball. But my guess is that the verdict will be murder by person or persons unknown, and they'll leave it at that.
Janie's steps slowed.
But what about justice?
The courts are busy. The weather is bad.
Seeing the expression on her face, Burke relented.
That doesn't mean it's over. If there are any new leads, the case will be reopened. If there's anything to find, trust me, I'll find it.
Janie could see Mr. Lacey's tall hat on the other side of the room. He was standing by the exit, in close conference with Janie's mother and Mr. Tilden.
"They would all very happily see Annabel hanged," said Janie quietly. "My mother has ranged herself wholeheartedly with Mr. Lacey."
"Because he owns an abbey?"
"No, not entirely. I think she believes she is avenging Bay, that she ought to have protected him from Annabel, and this is her chance to make amends."
"If you believe Mr. Lacey," said Burke flatly.
Janie glanced swiftly at Burke.
"Do you think he killed them, Mr. Lacey?"
"I wouldn't place money against it."
The trio by the door caught sight of Janie and Burke. Lacey's expression as he looked at Janie was not fond.
"You made an enemy today."
"Say rather that I didn't make a friend," said Janie.
"Is there a difference?" inquired Mr. Burke.
"I don't believe he thinks I'm important enough to dislike," said Janie frankly. "My mother has invited Mr. Lacey to stay with us at Elyria for the weekend, or, as he calls it, the Saturday to Monday."
"Are you trying to scare me?"
Burke was not amused by her imitation of Mr. Lacey's accent.
"You could come back to town. There's a train leaving in 20 minutes. You could be back on Monday morning in time for the verdict."
It was a tempting notion, to get on the train, to be free, even for 2 days.
"I can't," Janie said regretfully. "I can't leave Mother, not now. She may not look like it, but she is grieving. She's..."
The memory of the carriage ride back to Elyria flashed across Janie's mind, the crack of her mother's palm against Anne's cheek.
"She's not herself."
"All right," said Burke reluctantly. "But if Lacey so much as looks at you the wrong way, lock yourself in your room and find yourself a sturdy poker. Strike first, ask questions later."
"It's hardly so dire as that. I doubt Mr. Lacey would murder me in my bed. Bodies piling up might give people ideas."
"And," Janie added before Burke could protest,
"he wasn't yet in the country on the night of the ball."
"Or so he claims. Once I'm back in town, I intend to take a look at the passenger list for that ship. There should also be a few telegrams from across the pond waiting for me in the newsroom."
When Janie looked at him in surprise, Burke's cheeks reddened above his muffler. Gruffly, he said,
I made you a promise, didn't I? Find the truth and publish it. I'm still working on the first bit. If anything makes you nervous, anything at all, telephone the world's offices. If I'm not there, they'll leave a message for me.
If the telephone wires don't go down, said Janie. The wind battered against the windows of the courtroom, whipping the bare branches of trees into a frenzied dance. Stray flakes of snow dipped and eddied, a promise of more to come. Burke scowled at the slate-gray sky.
I hate to leave you here.
You're more used to me in town, said Janie lightly. Her mother, who never essayed a task that could be delegated to someone of inferior station, had sent Mr. Lacey to collect her. She could see him coming for her, his tall hat wending its way through the crowd.
Now go, or you'll miss your train.
Burke gave her hand a quick squeeze.
Be careful. It's treacherous out there.
Giles Lacey was nearly upon them. Janie looked from the man who had lied to her to the man who might have killed her brother.
I know, she said.
Chapter 24. Cold Spring, 1899. January 5th.
May I have a word?
Georgie caught up with Bay near the rose garden, or rather what would be the rose garden at some point in the spring. Right now it was a twig and thorn garden, spiky and joyless. He was conferring with David about the placement of the Chinese lanterns for tomorrow night. Rather a ridiculous exercise, thought Georgie, given that it was too cold for any sane person to voluntarily seek the outdoors. But then this was the cream of New York society they were inviting. Sanity wasn't always a prerequisite.
Certainly, said Bay, and waited.
Georgie darted a glance at David, who was tactfully inspecting a twig. Frustration seized her at having to beg for even this small crumb, the right to speak to her own bloody husband without a bloody audience.
In private?
I'll just be in the music room, said David, and disappeared around an elaborate bit of topiary, leaving Georgie feeling as though she'd kicked a puppy.
It would be easier if David weren't so likable, if she could indulge in the treat of thoroughly resenting her husband's lover without having to feel guilty about it every time she asserted her rights, whatever those were.
What is it? Asked Bay,
but Georgie couldn't help but notice the way his eyes flicked over her shoulder as he said it, marking David's progress back to the house.
Not here, said Georgie.
There were too many people about. Gardeners and caterers and goodness only knew who. Through the bare branches of the trees she could see the eaves of the old house, sturdy and plain.
Let's go to the old house. We can be private there.
Let's hope there's still some coal in the grate, joked Bay, offering an arm.
He hadn't minded the cold when he was with David.
Georgie pushed the thought aside, threading her arm through her husband's.
There was something about the nearness of him, his size, his touch, his smell, that made her feel safe, even now, even with Giles roaming the grounds, even knowing that David was in the music room waiting and hordes of guests were coming to disturb their peace tomorrow. There was something so very solid about Bay, so very safe. They'd weathered so much already. Surely together they could find a way to deal with Giles. Bay would understand. Georgie could feel the tight knot in her stomach beginning to relax at the thought of unburdening herself, being able, finally, to tell Bay the whole truth. He'd told her his truth. Now it was her turn. Imperfect lovers, that was what they were, and hardly lovers anymore. But at least their imperfections matched, two impostors showing false faces to the world. But not to each other. Not anymore. Surely that was a bond stronger than sharing a bed.
It does feel small after the new house, doesn't it? Said Bay, as they took the back stairs up to the nursery.
Georgie looked with affection at the narrow doorframe, the way the house closed around her like an embrace. It feels like home. Bay looked down at her, the skin around his eyes crinkling as he smiled. But Lacey Abbey is your home, your real home. In the nursery, old King Cole led his musicians in a merry measure, and little Bo Peep looked forlornly for her sheep. About that, Georgie began. Do you not like the house? Bay looked at her with concern, that look that always seemed to say that she was the most important thing in the world, and her wish was his command. Even when it quite frequently wasn't.
It's not about the house, not really.
Stalling, Georgie walked through to the empty nurse's room. She knelt by the grate.
There's enough coal for a fire.
I'll do it, said her husband, who had never lit his own fire in his life and stood looking helplessly from the kindling basket to the coal scuttle.
Here.
Striking a lucifer, Georgie lit a piece of kindling, setting it down on the grate. She placed sticks from the wood basket over it, waiting until they caught before reaching for the coal.
At least let me dirty my own hands, said Bay, and set down the chunks of coal for her, gingerly, on top of the kindling wood.
There was something about the way he looked at the smuts on his hands, trying to think of a place to wipe them clean, that made her heart twist, the way it did when Sebastian tried to feed himself and got porridge all around his mouth instead of in it.
Now, said Bay, putting both hands on her shoulders, what's wrong?
His sympathy almost undid her. For a moment it was 5 years ago, and she was alone and scared, and Bay was a broad-shouldered stranger, Sir Galahad and Lancelot rolled into one.
"Do you remember?"
Georgie began, and then had to stop and clear her throat.
"Do you remember when we first met, and I told you that I was raised as Annabel's companion?"
"Of course," said Bay fondly, but it wasn't hard to guess the truth.
That was the truth.
Bay blinked at her, and Georgie hurried on, trying to get it over with as quickly as possible.
You were so sure that it didn't seem worth arguing. And it seemed fair in a way to get to be Annabel, after all the trouble I had gone through for her sake.
Georgie's voice faltered to a stop. She wished Bay would say something, anything. She took a deep breath and laid herself bare.
The real truth of it is that I didn't want to risk losing you. You were everything I had ever dreamed of, and I couldn't bear to let you go.
She blinked away the tears stinging the back of her eyes. She'd got her deserts, hadn't she? She'd lied and seen her fairy tale turned on its head. If she'd been honest... No, it didn't work that way. And she had more than most. She had a friend. She hoped.
I don't understand, said Bay hoarsely.
Which meant that he did. Georgie's hands were shaking, so she wrapped them together, trying to steady herself. She knew him so well, her Bay. Her Bay who liked to avoid bother, who preferred to pretend not to see what he didn't want to see.
What I told you then was true, Bay. Annabel was my half-sister. My real name is Georgiana, Georgiana Smith. You would think they could have come up with a more inventive surname, couldn't you?
Georgie tried to smile, but it didn't come out quite right. It hurt, that smile.
You're not Annabel Lacey, said Bay.
He said it as though he hoped he were wrong.
Annabel is married to a sheep farmer in New South Wales. We had an arrangement. I would help her escape, and in return...
You can have Giles if you want him.
In return, I would take her place. It just didn't work out as well as we had planned.
You told me you were Annabel.
No.
She couldn't let him think that. She might have lied by omission, but never on purpose, not to Bay.
You decided I must be Annabel, and it was too much trouble to disabuse you.
Even as she said it, she realized how weak it sounded. She could see it in Bay's face and the way he looked at her, as though she were something unpleasant that had come out from under the carpet.
Bay, everything else was true. Everything else I told you. I did grow up at Lacey Abbey. I did have a brother named George who died. Annabel and I were sisters, Bay. Blood sisters.
Georgie reached for her husband, and he stepped back, away from her. She felt something in her chest turn to ash, like the coals on the hearth.
Why was it always like this? Why?
Always apologizing for not being Annabel, for being the lesser one, for wanting anything of her own. Georgie's voice rose.
I might have been Annabel if circumstances had been different. We had the same father and the same upbringing. My mother just lacked the marriage lines.
Bay's Adam's apple moved up and down. He pressed his eyes closed and then said hoarsely, "Who else knows?" Georgie swallowed a wave of hurt. That wasn't what she'd wanted. She'd wanted Bay to fold her in his arms and press her head to his chest and tell her not to worry, that a name was just a name, that she was the one he cared for, that he would make it all better, that he loved her, whoever she might be. Georgie forced her lips to move.
Giles Lacey. He came because of David.
And wasn't that something? She wasn't the only one who had omitted the truth, but they didn't seem to realize the parallels.
Will he expose you?
He says he will.
There was only a yard between them, but Bay felt a very long way away.
But Bay, I don't see how. It's just his word against ours. Who would believe him?
Unless he can find proof.
What sort of proof? Our nurse used to say she could only tell us apart when she saw us side by side. Even if someone were to see me, someone who knew us both. It's been 7 years, Bay. I've changed. Annabel will have changed too. Why couldn't I be Annabel now? Even if someone had pictures of us both, who's to say which is which now?
Pictures, Bay muttered, a strange expression crossing his face. He turned on his heel without another word, moving rapidly from the room. Georgie hurried after him.
Bay, wait!
But it wasn't the stairs he was heading for. It was their old bedroom. Georgie felt her chest constrict at the onslaught of memories, the way Bay had rubbed her feet when she was heavy with the twins, the way he had cradled her and read her poetry by the light of a single candle when their stirring and kicking had meant that she couldn't sleep. And Bay had said if she wasn't sleeping, then he couldn't either. Until he had fallen asleep, that was.
Bay, began Georgie, thinking of everything they had shared, of the children. We can make this right. I'm sure we can.
That's what I'm doing, said Bay tersely, dropping to his knees and pulling out a box from underneath the bed.
It was an old hat box, filled with a miscellany of papers and photographs. He brushed past her, the hat box round in his arms.
Making this right.
He was making back for the nursery, for the warmth of the nurse's room, where the coals cracked and popped on the grate.
What are those?
Georgie asked breathlessly, half tripping on her skirt as she stumbled after him, trying to close the distance.
Proof, said Bay in a clipped voice, and before she could stop him, he dropped a handful of papers on the grate.
Georgie coughed at the acrid smell as the photograph paper caught fire. She could see her own face begin to blacken and curl.
Bay!
She lunged for the grate, but her husband caught her by the wrist. Papers scattered.
Don't you see?
Bay's strong arm was between her and the grate, and Georgie could hear the desperation in his voice, the fear.
It's the only way to make it go away. If he doesn't have any pictures, he can't compare them.
Georgie smacked hard against his chest. That had been a picture of them both with the twins, her babies when they were still small enough to be held one in each arm. Gone. Gone up in smoke, as though it never was.
And what about me, Bay?
She smacked him again, her eyes blurred with tears.
How do you make me go away?
I'm not trying to make you go away.
Releasing her, Bay sat down heavily on the bed, like a puppet whose strings had been cut.
Then what's all...
Georgie gestured wordlessly at the floor. The debris of their life together lay scattered around her feet. A playbill from the Ali Baba. A photograph of her archery triumph that first summer at Newport.
You can't make the past 5 years go away by throwing them on the fire. It doesn't work that way.
I wasn't trying to get rid of the past 5 years. I just wanted...
What?
What else am I supposed to do, Georgie? How else am I supposed to fix this? Bay lifted his head and looked at her helplessly.
I don't know what to do, Georgie. I don't know what else to do.
Georgie looked at his bewildered face, feeling as though she'd rowed out from shore a long ways, only to find that the boat was leaking, probably had been leaking all along. Where was the bay she had thought she knew, the one who solved problems, who made everything better? He had never existed, she realized. She had invented him out of a quiet manner and a pair of broad shoulders.
We'll do what we always do, she said. Go on. Pretend it's not there. We're very good at pretending.
Just as they had pretended Charlie never happened, just as they pretended that David was merely a good friend, just as she had pretended to herself that once the house was finished and the ball was over, their lives would be different. But they wouldn't, would they? This was what it was, what they were.
Georgie, this is serious, Bay said, and Georgie felt her hackles rise, because what did that mean? Did it mean that nothing else was, had been?
I'm not even sure if our marriage is valid. I think it is, but it's not something that's ever arisen in my practice.
Our marriage is valid as long as we say it is.
Georgie stared at her husband, willing him to understand.
Who's to say I'm not Annabel if we both say I am?
Bay shook his head. The law doesn't work like that.
Why not?
Demanded Georgie.
I've spent years lying for you, Bay. I've let people accuse me of goodness only knows what so that your reputation can remain unsullied. I've let you keep your lover under the same roof as our children, for the love of God. And this is all you can tell me, that the law doesn't work that way.
Bay scraped a hand through his hair, the same color as Bast's.
What do you want me to do, Georgie? I can't change your birth.
The words left a nasty taste in Georgie's mouth.
Is that you speaking or your mother? Forgive me, I had forgotten about the great legacy of the Van Dyvels. I'm so sorry I tainted your sacred bloodline. You'll have to change the quarterings on your coat of arms now, won't you? Add a bar sinister and maybe some theater masks.
Bay let her rant herself out, speaking with a patience that made Georgie want to throw something straight at his head. I didn't mean it that way. I certainly don't think of you that way, but the world...
Bugger the world!
There was something strangely satisfying about the shock on Bay's face, about knowing she'd triggered some emotion.
Bugger them all! What do I care about the world, or the world about me? I cared about you, Bay, and I thought you cared for me.
Bay half rose from the bed.
I do. I do care for you.
Georgie blinked back tears.
But not enough to fight for me. Not enough to say to hell with the world, to hell with Giles Lacey, to hell with everyone who isn't us.
She wasn't aware of what she was going to say until the words came out, crackling in the air between them.
I want a divorce.
Georgie!
Bay looked like he didn't know whether to reach for her or back away.
You don't mean that, do you?
I...
It was mad. There were the children to think of. But Anne had been right. Divorce wasn't the bar it had once been. And the children were Van Dyvels. The Van Dyvel name covered a multitude of sins. And what would it be to be free? Not alone and scared as she had been all those years ago, but an independent woman of means.
I don't know.
Bay sank back down on the bed, looking up at her with a combination of concern and skepticism. Is this about David?
No, it's not about David, Bay.
except in so much as she wanted someone who looked at her the way David looked at Bay, as though she'd hung the moon in the sky.
I want someone who loves me enough to stand by me.
Bay's brow furrowed. Haven't I stood by you?
No, you whisked me away. It's not the same thing.
Bay's face was a mask of incomprehension. Georgie took a deep breath.
Let's put it this way. Would you have married me if you had known who I was?
The moment of hesitation told her all she needed to know. I married you knowing you were an actress, Bay offered.
It's not the same, is it?
Georgie smiled crookedly, because it was either that or crying.
I want someone who will tell the world to go to blazes for me. Maybe that person doesn't exist, but I'm sick of being second best, Bay.
But divorce? The way he said it made Georgie think of his mother.
Are you afraid you won't be received?
Bay showed a spark of life.
I don't care what Mrs. Astor thinks of us. But what about the children, Georgie? They'll be damaged goods. You know that. They're Van Dyvels. As you've pointed out, that counts for something in your world.
His world. Never really hers. Georgie wasn't sure what her world was, but she knew she wanted the chance to find out.
Alva Vanderbilt's children don't seem to have suffered.
It's not just the social repercussions. Georgie watched Bay struggle for the words and felt her heart ache for him. He looked up at her with that honesty she had never been able to resist. I do love you, Georgie.
I know.
Georgie sat down on the bed beside him and felt Bay's arm come around her shoulders. He smelled of Bay rum and Mrs. Garrett's own secret soap. So familiar, so safe. She wanted to bury her head in his chest and stay there forever. Georgie let her head drop into the familiar place on his shoulder. She didn't want a divorce. Not really. Not entirely.
We don't need to do anything hasty. Bast gets that horrible cough every winter. No one would think it odd if I were to take the twins away for a season. To Italy, perhaps. Or Switzerland. Just to see.
She could feel Bay's cheek against the top of her head, his breath ruffling her hair. How many times had they sat like this? Why not Florida? Bay asked, his voice muffled. Georgie rubbed her cheek against his jacket, feeling the rub of the wool. Your mother's rule extends to Sarasota Springs. Bay coughed in a way that sounded suspiciously like a sob. Don't take them away from me, Georgie.
Only for a season, Bay.
Georgie straightened in his arms, looking him in the face, seeing the familiar tracery of lines around his eyes, the faint gold around his chin.
You're their father. They adore you. I would never try to take them away from you.
What if I gave up David? Bay sounded like a little boy, promising to give up his pudding if it meant he could have his old dog back. What then? Part of Georgie wanted to leap at the offer. But what did that mean, really? That Bay loved her, she knew. But not enough. Never enough.
And make you miserable for nothing,
she said with an attempt at humor that failed utterly.
I want something for me, Bay. Something that's mine.
Not Annabelle's leavings, not the crumbs of her husband's attention. I would offer you jewels, said Bay with a touch of the wry humor that had won her heart. But I don't think that will answer, will it?
No, I've never longed for jewels.
Pushing herself up from the bed, Georgie began shuffling up the papers Bay had dropped on the floor, the ones that hadn't gone into the fire. Back into the hat box they went.
We should go back.
Bay didn't move. We can resolve all this, Georgie. I know we can. There's no need for divorce. Georgie looked down at her husband.
Even if Giles Lacey tells the world I'm not Annabelle, your mother will be clamoring for the papers to be drawn.
You said it yourself. If we stand together, it's our word against his.
Georgie admired the attempt at resolution, even if it wasn't entirely convincing.
Or we could pay him off.
No, said Georgie firmly. If we give him money, he'll only present that as proof that we had something to hide. We'll never be free of him, and neither will Viola or Sebastian.
Bay flexed his neck, wincing.
Then what are we going to do about him?
This was the response she had wanted, working together as a pair. But something about the way Bay said it made her feel more alone than before.
One thing she did know, she wasn't going to let Giles Lacey get the better of her. Not again.
Georgie held out a hand to help her husband up.
Leave him to me, Bay. I'll think of something.
Bay took the offered hand, rising stiffly to his feet.
I could have Mr. Tilden speak to him.
What is he going to do, bore him to death? Mr. Tilden would run straight to your mother, you know.
Bay grimaced.
Maybe that's what we need. There's no one more fearsome than my mother in a snit.
A snit doesn't sound very fearsome, said Georgie,
plunking the hatbox into her husband's arms.
It does, said Bay, when it's my mother.
Chapter 25 Cold Spring, 1899, February 11th.
You needn't show me the way, Mrs. Van Dyvel. I know it already.
Giles Lacey smiled a wolf's smile.
This is, after all, a copy of my house. An improved copy.
Janie watched her mother struggling to maintain a pleasant countenance. After a day of Giles Lacey, even her mother's vaunted control was wearing thin.
Without the inconveniences of the original.
Janie was beginning to wish she had followed Mr. Burke's advice and taken a train back to town. Snow had been falling all day, light flakes at first, and then heavier. It couldn't be past 3, but dusk was already beginning to fall, the uncertain light turning the snow-covered topiary into shambling snowmen, advancing on the house, pace by pace. The temperature hadn't risen, but the winds had, rattling the casement windows and finding the cracks in the masonry. Her mother was wrong. Mr. Proyne had done far too faithful a job of replicating Lacey Manor, leaks and all. Baronial mansions might be all very well for show, but they weren't very comfortable to live in with the mercury dropping well below 0.
That, said Giles Lacey, holding the door for Mrs. Van Dyvel, is only because I refused to sell the original.
Bats in the belfry and all, suggested Anne lazily.
But there was a nervous energy about her that belied her languid air. The look she directed at the backs of her aunt and their guest was decidedly inimical.
"The belfry was torn down in 1648," said Giles Lacey, in what was clearly a sore point. "A little matter of unpleasantness with some humorless souls in Parliament, and we didn't have bats."
"Everyone has bats," said Anne flatly. "Some are just battier than others."
"Don't be ridiculous, Anne."
Mrs. Van Dyvel swept into the small parlor with a rustle of taffeta and a tinkle of jet beads. She was in high dudgeon at the prospect of being forced to take dinner in the breakfast room, the dining room having been so cold that a frost had formed on the soup at lunch.
"We've never had bats on Fifth Avenue."
"No, of course not," murmured Anne, crossing into the small parlor, Janie behind her. "They wouldn't dare, would they?" Anne reminded Janie of the Nubian lion in the menagerie in Central Park, pacing warily in its cage, swishing its tail at perceived threats, ready to pounce if necessary. Because she also suspected Giles Lacey? Or because she feared being discovered? "Hell hath no fury," Burke had said, and while it might be a cliché, clichés were clichés for a reason.
Or she might just be building a mountain out of a perfectly humdrum molehill. Anne and her mother had always sniped at each other. Being snowed into a Gothic replica was enough to make anyone edgy.
Janie coughed as she took a well-upholstered chair at the back of the room. The smoke from the fire wasn't rising properly, making her feel as though she were being slowly kippered. Mrs. Van Dyvel looked at the fire with disfavor.
This is unacceptable.
Contrary to her expectations, the fire refused to reform its behavior.
Mrs. Garrett says we haven't enough coal for the larger parlors.
Anne draped herself over one of the sofas farthest from the fire. The roads are blocked. The coal men can't make their deliveries.
Ridiculous, pronounced Mrs. Van Dyvel. And when it runs out, what then? Are we meant to take an axe to the movables?
I would start with that table, said Giles Lacey, gesturing to a Louis XIV commode dripping with ormolu.
All that gold is hurting my eyes.
That, snapped Mrs. Van Dyvel,
is a historic piece.
Historically commissioned by Bay, Anne contributed from her spot on the sofa.
No one, said Mrs. Van Dyvel with a repressive glance at her niece, is throwing anything on the fire.
Like a great big pyre, Anne murmured. When Mrs. Van Dyvel glared at her, she said,
Well, it would be fitting, wouldn't it? Like a Viking chieftain being burned with his ship.
Was it the Vikings who did that?
I wouldn't remember.
Bay would know. Or are we not meant to speak of Bay? Mrs. Van Dyvel didn't answer. She only paced on and on, from fire to window to chair and back again, her skirts rustling, her beads glowing dully in the red light of the lamps. Her hands plucked at the brooch at her neck, a mourning brooch set with pale gold hair. Bay's? Or the boys who hadn't lived for Janie to meet them?
Janie couldn't blame her mother for being restless. She could see Bay in every cartouche on the wall, every fold of the curtains. His shadow stretched over them like an extra person in the room.
This house was Bay's creation, even more than it was Annabelle's, every piece chosen by Bay, and nowhere more so than this parlor. Janie half expected to hear Bay's step behind her, to turn and find him standing in the doorway, watching them all. Not a ghost, but Bay himself, as he had been. Perhaps she shouldn't have had quite so much of Mrs. Garrett's venison in bayberry sauce.
"Shall we play cards?" suggested Anne. "Or would you prefer charades, Mr. Lacey?"
Janie rose from her chair in the corner.
"I'll just go to the nursery and see how Viola and Sebastian are getting on."
"We can't play bridge without a fourth."
Anne rose from the sofa with surprising alacrity.
"If you must go, I'll go with you."
"Janie can go." Mrs. Van Dyvel turned to the long French windows looking out over the river, one hand touching the bunched fabric of the red velvet drapes. Her knuckles were white against the rich material.
"We must take care with Bay's son."
"And what of Bay's daughter?" Janie thought.
It wasn't malicious, she knew. It was just the way her mother was. One took one's family as one found them. Or so she kept telling herself. It was becoming harder and harder to believe it.
"And I wouldn't take a care?" Anne demanded.
"No one has ever accused you of being domestic." Mrs. Van Dyvel smiled acidly at Anne, her gold and silver hair shimmering like a helmet in the lamplight.
"Perhaps if you had taken a care, you might be in France right now."
"With my husband and his mistress? Is that what you recommend, Aunt Alva?"
Do you need someone to see you to the nursery?"
Mr. Lacey turned to Janie, a note of desperation in his voice, and Janie almost felt sorry for him. Almost.
"There's no need. I won't be long," said Janie.
Exiting with more haste than grace, she collided with Mrs. Garrett in the doorway. Mrs. Garrett stood her ground, looking at Janie in a way Janie vaguely remembered from the days when she and Bay had been very small, and Mrs. Garrett had been their nursemaid. It was a look that made her feel as though she had forgotten to wash behind her ears.
"Caller," said Mrs. Garrett tersely. "A caller?"
Anne abandoned her argument in the light of this new development.
"Is it an Eskimo, perhaps, or one of those snow creatures from the Canadian wilds?"
Mrs. Garrett didn't dignify that with a response.
"It's that man for you, Miss Janie."
"What man?"
Janie heard her mother saying, as Janie followed Mrs. Garrett through the passage into the great hall, where her caller was waiting.
Man might have been stretching the description slightly. Snowman might have been more to the point. Ice crusted over the scarf wrapped around his face. Snow was packed solid on the brim of his hat and flaked around him as he stepped stiffly forward.
Burke? Only his eyes were the same, bloodshot but still green. The rest of him was rendered unrecognizable in layers of cloth and snow.
You look like a snow monster.
The snowman pawed at his scarf to free his mouth, sending ice chips flaking. He was shivering so hard he could hardly speak.
I tried to telephone, but the wires are down.
Mrs. Garrett,
said her mother in freezing tones,
we are not at home to callers.
Janie looked back sharply to see both her mother and Anne behind her. Mrs. Garrett stood impassively to the side, as if disclaiming any responsibility.
What are you going to do? Inquired Anne sweetly. Have Garrett fling him into the snow? Just think what the papers would say.
Burke ignored them both. He advanced towards Janie, limping a little.
I need to speak to you.
How did you get here?
It had to be at least 10 below outside, possibly more. The papers had been calling it the coldest weather on record. That, of course, had been when there still was a paper. There had been no deliveries since the day before. The roads were impassable, Garrett said, not so much from the snow as the ice beneath it.
Walked from the station.
Burke shivered uncontrollably, his whole body swaying.
Phone lines are down. I caught the last train out. They've had to close off portions of the L because the rails are too slick. The Staten Island ferries are frozen in their docks. The snow is lying in the street because it's too cold to shovel, and there's more coming.
You need a fire,
said Janie, recovering from her paralysis and moving swiftly to Burke's side.
You need dry clothes and a warm drink before you get frostbite. Mrs. Garrett, is there any hot water to be had? Oh, and please prepare a room for Mr. Burke.
You'll do nothing of the kind, said her mother sharply. Give him something warm in the kitchen and see him out, Garrett. I refuse to allow this actor to stay under my roof.
Mr. Burke, said Janie through clenched teeth, is a journalist, and this isn't your roof.
Looking at Burke with concern, she added, You'd best get out of that coat. You've more snow on you than outside.
It's not the snow. It's the wind,
Burke said, and shook his head as though trying to wake himself.
You might ask Sebastian for permission,
suggested Anne to Janie. He is the master of the house, after all.
Don't be absurd, said Mrs. Van Dyvel shortly.
Anne shrugged.
It's not absurd. It's a legal fact.
Burke fumbled at the front of his coat, his frozen fingers sliding off the buttons. Janie moved quickly to help him.
Mrs. Garrett, would you prepare a room for Mr. Burke?
In the servants' wing, said Mrs. Van Dyvel sharply. He can take his meals in the kitchen.
Janie could feel her spine straightening, pulling her up to her full height, a good 3 inches taller than her mother.
If Mr. Burke takes his meal in the kitchen, then I will take mine there, too.
If we don't get more coal, muttered Mrs. Garrett, no one will be taking any meal anywhere.
No one paid any attention to her. Mrs. Garrett shrugged philosophically and retreated to her kitchen.
Send that to the kitchen and then come back to the library, said Janie's mother, and turned on her heel. Anne?
Burke grabbed Janie's sleeve.
Listen to me. Lacey lied. He was here in New York on the 1st. I found the ship's manifest for the St. Paul. He wasn't on it. He was on the Britannic.
His words were slurred, disjointed. Was that a symptom of hypothermia? Janie didn't know. She didn't particularly want to find out. Her fingers moved busily from button to button, releasing him from the icy prison of his coat.
You need dry clothes. Did you bring a bag?
Did you hear me?
Burke's teeth were chattering so hard he could hardly get the words out. His coat fell in a sodden heap on the floor, revealing a thinner wool coat beneath.
Lacey lied. He was here in New York on the night of the ball.